Thank you, brother, and good evening, everyone. It's good to be with you. I'm delighted to be here on time and unstressed. We're continuing our two-part study on the subject of work, and I'd like to begin by reading two small passages from the book of Genesis. First of all, Genesis chapter 3, starting at verse 17. Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. This is the word of God. And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." And then over to chapter 11, please. There's the famous story of the Tower of Babel. "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words, and as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." Now last week we thought about this strange idea that work is a blessing. God designed work to be a source of blessing in our lives. In his goodness, God has given us gifts and talents, and he's also placed us in a world full of resources, full of deep, untapped potential. And when you put those two things together, then you get work. When you put combine our creative talents with the potential of the natural world, we help to make life better for other people. Like a gardener, we are called to cultivate organizations and societies so that they are well ordered and which support human flourishing. Now, many in the evangelical tradition don't think about work in that way. They erect a dividing wall between the so-called sacred and secular. And that wall is best understood as a sort of schizophrenia. I'll never forget talking to a young graduate about his work in biotechnology. And we were discussing, I was annoying him, talking about things like genetic engineering, you know, the sorts of things which lead to the idea of designer babies and cloning and that sort of thing. And I said, "That must be a tough challenge for you as a Christian." And he stared at me for a moment and then shrugged his shoulders. "Not at all," he said. "When I'm in work, I put on my work head, and when I'm in church, I put on my church head." Far too many evangelicals think that the workplace has no spiritual significance, other than being a place where friendship evangelism can take place. Now, friendship evangelism is a really important thing, but it is not biblical to reduce work simply to an environment for outreach. Evangelicals have reduced the doctrine of work to a thin, shriveled thing, one that completely misses the creatorial mandate to cultivate the world and make it a better place. And in tonight's study, you'll be relieved to know we'll be much more practical. I'm sure if we went around the room and talked about our working lives, the air would be thick with stories about difficulty and frustration. So tonight we consider the question, why is work so hard? Well, as we just read in Genesis chapter 3, something happened to work. Work is no longer the pure, divinely designed thing we read about in Genesis 1 and 2 last week. One of the things that became damaged by the fall of man was work. We often think of the fall of man in a purely legal sense, don't we? You know, it's the introduction of sin into the world and into our lives, and that makes us objects of God's wrath. Well, that is true. But the Bible shows us time and time again that sin is more than a legal thing. It leads to the disintegration of every area of life, spiritual, physical, social, cultural, psychological. And that breakdown happens because sinful men and women no longer follow their design plan. Once we replace God's authority over our lives with our own personal authority, then life starts to break down. Now, to stop this talk being an unstructured ramble, I have organised my thoughts a little. We'll consider three ways in which sin has damaged work, and then we'll think about three practical guidelines for us to follow in the workplace. So, three problems that we face, and three principles to follow. So, the first way that sin has damaged work is best illustrated from the story of the Tower of Babel. At a superficial level, the story is one of innovative engineering, isn't it? I don't know if any of you are engineers in the room. A new technology was created, bricks being used in the construction industry instead of stone. And this new technology was used to build an impressively engineered tower. Now, what could be wrong with innovative engineering? Well, the text points out the motivation of the men involved. Let us make a name for ourselves. That simple phrase sums up the selfish motive that has corroded the gift of work. Instead of seeing work as a way of serving others, a way of making things better, work has become a way to show others that I am better than them. It's become a way to accumulate power and security, to exercise control over my own destiny. In the words of Tim Keller, work shifted from what he calls grateful stewardship to a neurotic fabrication of self-worth. The builders of Babel wanted to maximise their power and glory and autonomy. And they were doing something really profound. They were attempting to construct a sense of identity. Now, in the Bible, we are given a name. Revelation 2:17. The risen Christ promises us this: I will give him a white stone with a new name written on the stone that no one knows except the one who receives it. But the builders of Babel were making a name for themselves. To use some modern psychobabble, their sense of identity was a social construct. My point is this: work is a breeding ground for idolatry. Most corporate boardrooms all look the same. Huge walnut table, leather swivel chairs, video conferencing facilities. But at a spiritual level, they are also similar. The idols of power and pride and wealth are enshrined in just about every business on the planet. Let us make a name for ourselves. Well, that is the unwritten mission statement of most human enterprises. And idolatry has a truly horrible consequence. You become like the thing you worship. That's a principle of life. So if a corporation worships power and wealth, then it will be full of grasping, power-mad egoists, consumed with avarice and selfishness. The idea of just doing the right thing is regarded as a contemptible piece of naivety. It's a dog-eat-dog world where everyone is genuflecting to the idols of power and wealth. Now, sin has damaged work in a second way. Turn with me, please, to the little book of Ecclesiastes. We're going to read a longer section in a moment, but for this stage, I just want to pull out one verse from chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 8. The easiest way is to go to Isaiah. Go to Isaiah and turn left. Ecclesiastes 5 verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched over by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. This is a magnificent description of bureaucracy, isn't it? The explanation for social injustice is found in the endless delays, the office politics that pervade the tiers of management within this particular provincial government. Justice isn't lost because of the actions of one particularly nasty individual. It's lost within the tiers of a huge, inhuman bureaucracy. Now, contrast that verse with the picture we got in the Garden of Eden. In Genesis 2, Adam had the satisfaction of designing a project, working hard at it, and then seeing the benefits of the results. The results of his activity were obvious and clear, so he could take satisfaction in them. But in modern life, millions of people are trapped in structures that have robbed them of that basic human need, the need to see the fruit of their labours. Think for the moment about a typically modern production line. Walk through a car factory. You might see a worker who spends all day, every day, putting 5 nuts onto wheel lugs every 30 seconds. Hour after hour, day after day, it is mindless, repetitive, and unsatisfying. There is no doubt that modern production techniques are highly efficient. But the structures we have created in commercial organisations and in governments, they are responsible for a terrible feeling of alienation in the working classes. Karl Marx, I can't believe I'm quoting Karl Marx here, but anyway, he was the first person to speak of alienated labour in the heyday of the early 19th century. Here's what he says. Thousands of workers crowd into industrial centres, working 14 hours a day at physically debilitating, mentally stultifying factory jobs. I'm sure many of you here own an iPhone, yes? The biggest factory in China, which manufactures those amazing devices, is a very disturbing sight. Men and women are reduced to mere machines, robots, controlled by quality and productivity targets that stretch them to breaking point. The stress in the workplace was so great, some of you will know, that workers started to commit suicide by jumping off the roof. The plant managers responded by erecting netting around the roof. I'm not singling out any particular company. Apple have actually worked hard to attempt to make conditions better, but the point still stands, doesn't it? Sinful people have created structures that dehumanize other people, reducing them to mere things. And as a consequence, ordinary working people in an industrialized society can feel this terrible sense of alienation. So first, my first point was, work is a breeding ground for idolatry. Secondly, work is a cause of alienation. But my third and final point here is that work is a place of frustration. Let's now read our main passage from Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 17 to 26. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled, and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What is a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart doesn't rest. This also is vanity. We'll finish that. I'm sure some of you have driven past the Nortel complex, which is just off the Doak Road near Glengormley. The first time I visited Nortel's Belfast plant was way back in 1999, just before the dot-com bubble burst in March 2000. And working in the IT industry as I did in that period was the most extraordinary experience of my business life. The world went mad. Serious managers started to listen to investment analysts. I remember sitting in San Jose watching venture capitalists fall over each other to throw millions of dollars at companies with no assets, no business plan, just an idea pitched by some enthusiastic 25-year-olds. Back in those intoxicating days, executives who negotiated their pay package didn't even worry about salaries. Everything was measured in terms of stock options. Salaries were described as beer money. In 1999, the new Belfast Development Centre was the jewel in the crown of Nortel's European empire. I don't know where you have been, but there were these sweeping open plan spaces stretched out in all directions full of sleek office furniture. Hundreds of talented software engineers worked on the fiber optic technologies that were driving the so-called e-business economy. But then, the bubble burst. Dot-com suddenly became dot-bomb. In March 2000, the Nasdaq was over the 5,000 mark. 18 months later, it was at 1387. 75% of market value wiped away in a year and a half. It was a bloodbath. And behind those figures lies a real human cost. A few years ago, I walked through that complex on the Dove Road. Most of the Nortel buildings were empty. The neat lines of cubicles were in disarray as the furniture was disassembled for resale. Half a desk sat forlornly in the middle of the lobby. The network test beds, which once had been full of state-of-the-art multiplexers, were just rows of skeletal metal racks. I walked past a jumble of broken office chairs. One of them, somebody had used Tippex to write the initials J-U-B. I don't know who it was, perhaps some long-suffering engineer got tired of colleagues borrowing his chair without permission. But the little dramas of office life had ceased. Only the impersonal hum of the fluorescent uplighters broke the silence. J.U.B. no longer sits in his chair. Just another casualty caught up in the bloodbath that engulfed the telecoms industry in 2002. I saw a stained Microsoft project plan on the floor, an empty carton of herbal tea on a dusty desk. The only relics left of a dream. When I think of that scene, the words of Coldplay's brilliant Viva La Vida song come to mind. I used to rule the world. Seas would rise when I gave the world, when I gave the word. Now in the morning I sleep alone, sweep the streets I used to own. When I talk to businessmen about the Christian gospel, I nearly always start off with the book of Ecclesiastes. They just get it. I do an evangelistic talk for businessmen sometimes, and I entitle it From Tigger to Eeyore, My Career in Business and Other Failures. The happy optimism of youth is transmuted into a quiet cynicism of middle age. You get to the point where you think the whole scheme is pointless. Even success, if you read the text, even success is just a temporary blip that's quickly lost in the sea of events. There is this profound existential frustration that can cause many middle-aged workers to slip into depression. Now, why does this happen? What is it about this fallen world that causes so many to feel a deep frustration in the workplace? Well, remember that the ground was cursed after the fall. In the language of Paul, the whole of creation is groaning with frustration. It's just built into the fabric of fallenness. But people refuse to accept that diagnosis. They insist on being a Tigger. Walk onto the main Google campus at the moment and you'll meet hundreds of Tiggers. They are drunk with the idea that they can change the world into a beautiful, unfallen utopia. So many people start off in work life with hugely ambitious dreams to change the world. But their dreams are too big, too based on self-confidence. So they fade away. They're replaced by the quiet cynicism of an Eeyore. The root problem is that the humanistic optimism of some sort of utopia is unrealistic. That's the problem with humanism, isn't it? It just never works. Because it ignores the reality that we are living under a curse. So work is hard for three reasons. Work is a breeding ground for idolatry. If we set out to make a name for ourselves, then we will be consumed by the idols of power and wealth. Secondly, work is a cause of alienation. The industrialized nations have created structures that dehumanize ordinary working people. And thirdly, work is a place of frustration. The utopian dreams of humanism always founder against the reality of the curse that has been placed on this fallen world. Now, I want to think about three simple principles that should guide our working lives. They're very simple. Expect thorns, avoid idols, and redeem the workplace. First, we should expect thorns and thistles. Now, to illustrate this point, let me talk about the practical subject, as I promised I would last week, the practical subject of workplace harassment, bullying. It is a serious problem in many people's lives. Harassment, when it is genuine, is about the abuse of power. It involves pressurizing, humiliating, or threatening another person in a way which undermines their self-esteem and their self-confidence. I know a young teacher who was systematically bullied by supervisors who insulted her, threatened her, and called her a failure. Her written work was thrown on the floor. She was publicly humiliated in front of 60 people. She was made to stand in the corner of a room like a naughty child, even though she was in tears. Her self-esteem was shredded by systematic bullying. She began to believe the lies of her supervisors who were shouting at her. And the situation became all-consuming. She wasn't eating regularly. She had no social life whatsoever. Her health started to fail. So let me give a couple of practical tips about workplace harassment, and then we'll revert to the general principle of expecting thorns. The first tip is to build a set of relationships with senior people in your organisation. When someone is harassed by their immediate boss, the victim can feel trapped and isolated. They worry that their performance is only seen by the person who has it in for them. They also worry that if they go over the head of their boss, they will be portrayed as a one-dimensional troublemaker, the professional victim. In work life, prevention is always better than cure. So you may wish to consider building good, friendly relationships with your boss's peers and higher in the organisation. I don't mean some sort of crude PR campaign. Be careful not to fuel any paranoid feelings in your boss's mind. But pray for opportunities to do work that will be visible to a wider audience. If you get the chance to display your passion for work to senior managers, or even get the chance to build a rapport with them at a purely social level, then it stops you being perceived as a one-dimensional victim. You see, here's the thing. In general, senior managers just want problems to go away. That's all they want. If they only ever discuss you in the context of a personnel problem, then you are in a weak position. The only caveat I'd place on that tip is make sure you never rob your boss of his or her glory. But a careful cultivation of good relationships with senior managers can be a helpful antidote to the casual lies emitted by an office bully. The second practical tip is this: build a plan. Victims of harassment often fluctuate wildly between a grin and bear it attitude and an impulse to resign the next day. One of the best techniques to gain a sense of proportion is to build a plan. So you might say to yourself, I will behave in this way for the next 3 months. If that doesn't work, then I will try the second tactic. And if that doesn't work, I will consider a more radical options in a year's time. And a simple plan like that can help you put you back yourself back in charge of the situation and start to take away the feeling of helplessness. And it'll also prevent you from overreacting. As a general rule, I would say that going to tribunals or issuing formal complaints should be a last resort. Now, there are times when that path has to be walked. But certainly in the private sector, always try to sort the issue out informally. In the early phases, beware of putting stuff in emails or letters. It is much easier, you know, to be brave in an email than in a face-to-face meeting. But strongly worded emails are nearly always a bad idea. I had a great boss who once told me, by all means, write that email, Jim, just never send it. So make sure that one of the first steps in your plan is to confront your bullying workmates or boss. Now, even that idea may make some of you feel sick with apprehension. Well, I'm afraid there's no substitute for eye contact and face-to-face discussion. Now, workplace bullying is just one example of the thorns and thistles we encounter in the workplace. The Bible teaches us that we should expect these sorts of things to come into our lives at some times. The Apostle Peter talks openly about times when we have to suffer. Remember this very simple principle. Suffering is not the opposite of blessing. That is so important, I'm going to repeat it. Suffering is not the opposite of blessing. God can allow difficult work situations to arise in order to help you mature into a strong son or daughter of the Most High. And the way you react to difficulties in the workplace can have a profoundly positive impact on your Christian witness. It's a common thing to say that you learn what people are like by watching their actions. Personally, I don't agree with that. I think you learn what people are really like by watching their reactions. It's how we react to events beyond our control that opens up a window to the soul. So imagine the impact of non-Christians when they see a believer reacting to injustice or suffering in a Christ-like way. They might expect paranoia, bitterness, a desire for revenge, you know, smile and mark them down for death. That's the normal way of business. But if they see a calm resilience in the face of suffering, then, in the language of Peter, they will ask you to explain the reason for the living hope within you. So expect thorns and don't see them as the opposite of blessing. Before I leave this point, let me deal directly with one form of suffering that relates directly to our topic. The problem of redundancy. We live in a time of great economic uncertainty. And the fallout from that fact is not best measured in statistics. It's seen in the haggard face of a businessman who has just lost his job. Seen in the tired eyes of a young mother who's forced to pack up all her belongings and move to a cheaper form of rented accommodation. How should we react when a difficulty like that enters our life? Philippians 4:19, Paul says, "And my God will meet all your needs according to the riches of his glory in Christ Jesus." But you have to read that very carefully. Remember that the riches of God's glory, that is a currency that's not the same as sterling. Sometimes the shock of economic hardship can cause the believer to go back to basics and ask themselves this profound question: what is valuable in my life? A few months ago, I was talking to a young Christian man. A year earlier, he had got married. He and his young wife had emigrated so that he could take up a dream job. Before he left, he told his friends that God had given him the job. He had been selected out of hundreds of other applicants. He was delighted to know that he was in God's will. Well, 3 months into the job, he was made redundant through no fault of his own. He and his wife had to move back to Northern Ireland. He had no job. He told me how he used to hide his face when he went into the unemployment office to collect his welfare benefits. Other Christian friends seemed to be getting on well in their lives, buying houses, getting promotions, starting families. He and his wife had been forced to move into a small apartment that wasn't in the best of areas. "How did you get through those dark days?" I asked him. He looked across at his young wife with infinite tenderness. "She was so strong," he said. "She never complained once. Just got on with it, kept my spirits up." Throughout the evening I spent with him and others, I furtively watched them interact. And I'll tell you this. Maybe their bank balance wasn't in great shape, but it has been a long time since I have seen a couple who shared such a deep love. The economic trial had allowed the man to see the inner beauty of his young wife, and now he treasured her more than he had on their marriage day. I know businessmen who have tens of millions of pounds in the bank, but who have no idea what it really means to love and to be loved. A different currency, isn't it? A supplementary point emerges from that story. It relates to the role of the spouse during times of economic hardship. At the risk of being labelled sexist, I'm going to suggest that in the society in which we live, being made redundant is more difficult for a man than for a married woman. I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying that is a fact. I think it's a social thing, because a man's self-esteem is very often bound up in their job. In our society, when a man asks another man, "What do you do?" it's often interpreted to mean, "What sort of person are you?" Now, that's not a Christian position, of course, but it's the world in which we live. So when a man loses his job, that event can have a devastating effect on his self-esteem. That's why so many men become depressed when their careers run into trouble. A crisis in a man's career can leave him feeling vulnerable and depressed. So the role of his spouse, if he's married, during this period has a crucial importance. The Bible tells a story of an ancient man called Job who lost everything. His business, his health, most of his family. But he also had the misfortune to be married to an unspiritual, unfeeling woman. She went to her husband when he was feeling at his lowest and she told him to curse God and die. She was just venting her own frustration on her husband, and I guess some women do behave like that, don't they? But when a man really wants to work, when he longs to provide for his household but cannot through no fault of his own, then that is the time when his wife can quietly manage the readjustment, show her husband that she respects him rather than his job title. The love that a man has for his wife or his children is a wonderful and valuable thing. The point you're considering can be applied at a deeper level, can't it? Recall once again Paul's statement in Philippians about the riches of God's glory. Sometimes it can take economic hardship to force a person to remember the riches they have in Christ. That young man I was telling you about a few moments ago, he told me that one morning he was sitting eating his breakfast, wishing that he had a job to go to. And suddenly a line from an old hymn came into his mind. The words that moved him to tears were these: "The King of love my shepherd is, his goodness fails never, I nothing lack if I am his, and he is mine forever." As he sat at that breakfast table, a young believer had rediscovered what was really important and valuable in life. He discovered that suffering is not the opposite of blessing. The second practical principle, and I'm going to speed up here, for us to consider is to avoid idols. John's first epistle has a most curious ending. The apostle finishes off his letter with the simple phrase, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." As children, we were all taught the story of Daniel's three friends. They lived in a society that genuflected before a huge idol built on the plains of Dura. The entire empire bowed down before that idol. Every form of authority, every expression of art and culture and music bowed down before this great idol. But three young men refused. They were respectful and courteous, but they did not bow down to the cultural idols in their midst. So with us. In the workplace, you will enter a place which is riddled with idolatry. Now, it's possible that some of the idols in our own culture have found their way into your heart. Well, there is no easy solution here. We must ask the Lord, and mean it, to tear them down. And tearing down idols can be a painful business. I spent most of my adult life as a corporate animal. I used to carry around little pieces of card in my wallet, and these little things were called business cards. Now, to most sane human beings, business cards are just exist to furnish the people we meet with our contact details. Nothing very idolatrous there, you might think. But for a period of my life, I worshipped the job title on my own business card. My career had become an idol. I didn't intend to tell you this, but I will. I'd set myself the goal of being a director in my company by the time I was 40, and I achieved that. And on the very week that I was, my PA brought in my business card, was the week that my wife told me that she had leukemia. And then a few years later in 2007, when I left corporate life, I had to experience the pain of an idol being torn down. And that process really hurt. But I am so glad that such a false thing has been removed from my heart. And the final practical point is this. We should set out to redeem the workplace. The Christian should view all of life through the context of the gospel, within the context of the gospel. And in these talks, I hope I have shown that great gospel framework, that grand framework, which starts with the way things should be. And then it explains why things have gone wrong. And then it sets out to redeem the situation. That is the structure of the grand gospel narrative. And that sort of gospel thinking can be applied to any workplace. Begin by thinking about the way things should be. Then analyse what has gone wrong, and then work to redeem the situation. So if you work in a dog-eat-dog selfish world, then as a deliberate policy, set out to demonstrate the Christian values of serving others, of putting their interests above your own. Or if you work in an organisation that demeans and dehumanises its workers, then use sanctified imagination to make the lives of working people more interesting and satisfying. Ask yourself, how can you redeem the culture of your organisation so that it becomes more ordered, less chaotic, more productive, more fruitful, and make a significant contribution to human flourishing? Now, to try and earth that point, let me close by asking you a question. Do you pray about your workplace? You see, way back in the Garden of Eden, in the cool of the evening, I think Adam went walking with God. Perhaps he would discuss his day's work, his ideas and challenges, the little experiments he was thinking about doing. And we can do the same thing. Now, we must work in an environment where there are thorns and thistles. But we're still gardeners called to cultivate God's world. So each day we can talk with God about our workplace. And I don't just mean praying for the salvation of our co-workers. I mean praying about decisions that you must take or design challenges that you are grappling with. Remember, God is the divine engineer. He is the divine physician. He is the divine manager, the divine carpenter. So he finds your work life interesting. So why not talk to him about it? So there we have it. Work is a blessing. But it is hard because the workplace is a breeding ground for idolatry. It is the cause of alienation. And it is a place of frustration. But as believers, we're called to expect thorns, to avoid idols, and to redeem the workplace. May God bless his word to our hearts.